you're a unicorn. So you are this rare and mythical creature. And at the minute you realize that, I think women have a couple of choices. One is that you fold and retreat, because that is a very scary prospect that's super uncomfortable. And on a number of days, that's a really valid response, because we cannot have energy every day to be the unicorn. It's too much.
Yep.
But if you can, then the beauty in being a unicorn and being rare and mythical is that you are instantly seen, and that half the battle of being heard is being seen. And so you have this golden opportunity to be heard.
Welcome back to Amplifying Us. I'm Lindy Nelson. This is a place where you can be inspired to act on and explore your own potential through the real, the raw, and the intimate stories of other women. Finding purpose and belonging, the confidence and the courage to act isn't always easy. Here is where I hope you feel you belong in the conversation. My next guest today is Rachel Tolele. In her day job, she is CEO of Konu, a Māori-owned New Zealand farming food and beverage organisation exporting globally, aspiring to be the world's best indigenous food and beverage provider. She's chair of APEC Business Advisory Council, director of New Zealand Hops and the Aquaculture New Zealand. And as with so many women attempting to distill the essence of Rachel down to an introduction, well, it's beyond challenging. Until a couple of years ago, I didn't know her. Our paths, our worlds had not crossed. I first learned about her when I was asked at the last minute to stand in for her and speak at Huihui Nawahine. I said yes, of course. As it turns out, not knowing her was a good thing. As if I had known the day the boots I was attempting to fill, I would have said no. You get a sense when you are in her presence that you're lucky to be there. I think as a leader, you would follow her anywhere. She's smart, she's honest, she's commanding. And I think maybe it would be hard to say no to her. She has a deep understanding of herself as a leader, knowing both her strengths and her limitations, and the effect she has on who she leads. To be honest, I'm slightly in awe of her and very grateful for the opportunity to kōrero, which is why I've turned up today at her house with some kai, or food. Some of the themes we're going to unpick today is understanding ourselves as leaders. Who we are is how we lead, our personality. How taking the time to deeply understand our value, then articulate that, helps us find our voice. And how embracing the unicorn in us allows us visibility. And when we are visible, we're in a position to be heard.
Tēnā koe, Rachel. And thank you so much for having me in your whare today. It's we're all shut in inside, so we don't see the beautiful Wellington Harbour, but we want good recording. So
we know the main thing. We know it's gorgeous outside it's Wellington.
It is Wellington. It is Wellington. But thank you very much for agreeing to have a chat to us about leadership, and really feminine leadership. So a lot of leadership models, frameworks, and what we see in the world is quite masculine, with a masculine lens, and you are a strong Māori female leader in Aotearoa doing some incredible things. And so we kind of want to get under the lid, if that's okay with you, around your journey. Some of the things that you've discovered work really well, maybe some of the things that don't work really well, and share that little bit of your story.
Fun. I'm looking forward to this chat, to our kōrero.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So let's start with your leadership journey. Where did it start? Probably school, I bet.
It did start at school. Yeah. I think.
I thought so.
You're probably thinking she was probably some kind of crazy overachiever. I think it probably did start there, and it started with, even maybe a little bit before then, because when I was growing up, my parents created an environment where anything was possible. Mm. I think I was raised with the idea that if you wanted to do it, then just do it. And the only limitation to any of that was your thinking, and your the decision you might make not to follow through was the only thing that impeded your ability to go somewhere or do something. So when you're built like that, then you follow through. So while I was at school, you know, you try every sport and you get on into representative netball in my case. When you're tall as a young girl, you better put that to use. And so I put mine into netball. And then, you know, I really loved, depending on who my family you ask, they might say I love the sound of my own voice, but I would say I loved, you know, presenting and pushing a point, and so got into debating and speech writing, speech and drama, so that was good fun. And then in seventh form, I was really lucky to be the recipient of an award that took me to Boston and put me on a tall ship, and we sailed from Boston to Liverpool. That took about 4 weeks. But it was called The Soren Larsen. And so all of these things, you know, they build, they start building you out as a young person, where what you thought was possible previously, you know, then gets wider and broader and more colourful. And then it's up to you as a person as to whether or not you take up that space.
You enjoyed growing? You enjoyed the challenge?
I did. I don't want to say there was a naivety to it, but I didn't feel limited. So I think if you don't feel the limitations or the weight of challenge, then I think it can become really liberating in what you do in places that you might find yourself. And that I think that certain times in our lives we do feel weighed down by challenges, and that you see that you yourself retracting either professionally or personally, but it's at those times where you don't, that you really do shine.
Yeah, I totally get that. It's going to come back to your earlier, but you loved debating. Was it about being right, or was it about being curious?
Definitely right. And also maybe, and I loved being in the first position, because you always got to the last word. So you let out hard and you wrapped it up at the end, and so nothing was left to chance. So early on, for sure, definitely about being right, because if there was certainty, then you could feel, you know, a little bit stronger about your position and what you were pushing. So yeah, first and last.
How has that changed in leading people?
It's very interesting, actually. It depends, I guess, at the stage of my career that I look at. So when I was with New Zealand Trade Enterprise, straight out of university, I went into a team as a team administrator, thinking I was, you know, pretty fantastic because I had a law degree under my arm, and I wasn't staying for long, and I was really off to be a lawyer. But I fell in love with trade, so I stayed. And really, that was an enormous period of learning for me, less of leading. Then I went to the States and was appointed as trade commissioner, young, appointed by a woman who I would very squarely call a champion for me. And I'm interested in ideas of what it is to be a champion versus a sponsor versus a mentor.
A
champion for me is somebody who sees a sort of a flicker of potential in you and puts you in positions that they think that you can do well in. So you sink or swim, essentially.
Yeah.
And she's done that to me a couple of times in my life. So she fired me up to the States. Away you go. And I did have a team there, but I think I was too young to understand what leadership really was. I was in love with the idea of being the trade commissioner and presenting and representing New Zealand food and beverage companies, and that was a lot of fun. So
who wouldn't be in love with that idea?
I know, yeah, and there was so much. There was no end to the stories, no end to how good we were, and no end to the audience who wanted to hear all about that. So
what's the time frame? What year are we talking here?
I was like 17. No, yeah. It would have been in the 90s, late 90s.
Yeah. Okay, so the real beginning of starting to get a new bit of a New Zealand story around food.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, they really had no idea where we were from, but they loved the idea of it. And, you know, you'd reference New Zealand, they'd say, oh, I've been to Sydney. And it's like, well, that's excellent too.
Nearly there, nearly there.
Also interesting.
I say, hey, look, I come from Mekitahuna.
Exactly. Mekitahuna.
Yeah. So I get that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that leadership at that point for me was still listening, I think, and taking it all in. And then it wasn't until I came back to New Zealand, I started Yellow Brick Road, sustainable seafood company. You're a startup for 10 years, and so you're just sprinting all of the time, still gathering experiences. And it's only now in my role within Kono, where I do have a much broader team, you're part of a much bigger whānau structure, that you can start putting all of those experiences into play, and where within Yellow Brick Road, I had to have all the answers all the time because you're a startup and you're responsible for everything. Now I have a team, and now it's more important oftentimes for me to listen as opposed to speak, and to synthesize what everyone is saying and the feelings behind all of that, and then come up with answers and solutions from there, but by directed by that. So you know, I probably still fight the urge to be right. That's always in my hardwiring. But I think I'm much more open to being proven wrong. And I actually love it when that happens. I love it when the team say, I actually disagree with you. And here are the five reasons why.
We have to create that, yeah. You have to create a safe space for people to disagree with you. And when you're right all the time, that's not creating that safe space really for them at all, is it there? I like the idea that you said feelings, because actually we are, you know, feeling people who occasionally think. We are not thinking people who occasionally feel. And so feelings really do drive behaviour. And I think women particularly are quite good at tapping into some of those feelings. So in your team, how do you gauge that sort of thing?
I have to really work at that. You know, this is a time and a conversation in which to be really honest about that, but I have to work at it, because I think when I came into my role, I got together a team, as many people as I could put my hands on, and I said, hey, look, so there's going to be no sudden movements. We're all going to do this together. No one likes change, but you've just had a change of CE and I'm the new one and here I am, and we're just going to all do this together. And it felt like the right thing to do. Pretty sure I read it in some first 90 days manual. So I rolled it out.
I think
on them.
I've read that one too.
If you get that one, yeah, just everyone's long. But then a couple of weeks later, I had to get everyone back together and say to them, oh, I'm really sorry, that's never going to work, because I'm much more of a hustler, I suppose. We're like, we're going to move, and we're going to move at pace, but we're going to do it in a way where we all feel a part of it. And so I think you have to behave in a way that's authentic to you, recognizing that, you know, there might be 10 things you need as a leader, and when you come into roles of leadership, invariably you have 2.5, and you build the others as a result of the people who you surround yourself with, or that you surround. And so working on the feelings component for me is tough, because it requires great empathy, and that's always one of those things that it's a work in progress for me.
Yeah. But you know that,
So I do know it. A DISC profile told me it, actually. Yeah. I guess it confirmed what you know already, where, you know, I sort of have this standing joke in our family where when I enrolled at university, I was going to do medicine, and then at the last minute decided not to, because I realised that I couldn't do any more chemistry and that I had not as much empathy as one might need for sick people. And so sort of shuffled left in the law line. But the DISC profile said to me, you know, here's 32 strengths that every person has, and at the top of yours is WOO, which is an acronym for Win
Others
Over.
That's amazing, yeah.
Have you got the same one?
No, I don't have WOO, but people with WOO, you can tell. You can tell they've got it, yeah.
So I got WOO, and I thought, oh, well, that's pretty good. And then I was like, oh, work down the list. And by the time you get to the end of it, your 32nd trait is one that you have, but you have to work at that, and for me it was empathy, and luckily I wasn't actually the only one, I just brought down but it is one of those things you think, yeah, that is, because when you're moving at pace, you have to by design ensure that you have everyone with you, because if you get too far in front of your team or even anyone that you choose to be with, you know, you might get a shot in the backside because you're too far ahead. And so as a person in leadership, it's just thinking, what is the role of a leader? And the role of the leader is to create space for others to shine. It's to grow other people. It's to provide them with surety of direction and space to be as good as they can be.
Thank you. So who you are is how you lead, which is our personality. It's about understanding that, isn't it, and knowing it.
Yeah.
And we don't have it all. So we surround ourselves with others who've backfill our big gaps and let us know. I know when I was running the team for Agri Women's Development Trust, I was just always way, way ahead.
Yeah.
And actually someone in the office, she was my just tell me how it is person. So when I was outside of my integrity, say I'm going to do something and do something else, she'd just be following me down the corridor. Mm. Lindy, when you did this, here's the impact on the rest of it. And that was fantastic because it was in the moment, yeah, getting the feedback when you needed it. It's a bit hard on me sometimes, but that's the role of the leader, isn't it?
It really is, to know yourself well enough that you know your effect on people.
Yeah.
And to be able to use that in really constructive and positive ways is, it's really hard. So you have to get into what is the great part of your personality and what do you do with that? And equally, when it's that kind of balcony basement view of it. So when it's on its balcony, it's amazing. But when you've got a basement version of it, it can be tough and it doesn't play out as you might imagine it.
Absolutely. So you've got those feedback loops in your team. What about amongst your wider friend group? Because we share a friend in Mavis Mullins, and she's really good at giving me those feedback loops. Yeah,
she's really good. We do have it in our team, which is really good. And I'm really lucky in our whānau business that sort of four of our six senior leadership team are whānau. And so we start our days and our conversations and our lives from a really high placed of trust and love.
Yeah.
And so it really matters little what the content of those conversations is, because you can have robust conversations the way that you do with family, but your intention is the same. And I really am incredibly lucky to have that. So we have a lot of collective thought, which is different from groupthink, but we try to get to a similar place, albeit sometimes in different ways. So that's lucky. And Karenza, who's the CEO of Wakatūan Corporation, she and I went to university together, so we've been besties since uni days, which is really just such a delight and privilege to be able to now work together. So that's good. So we have an incredibly honest and supportive relationship there. And then within my group of friends and whānau, I would say my husband is probably my greatest truth teller, and he can see straight through me as if I'm a piece of pane of glass. And so he will know on any given day if I'm getting a little bit of ahead of myself or whether I'm not backing myself in a certain situation. And he's very logical and clear about his position on things, but equally he knows me well enough to know when to kind of keep your feet on the ground, but also your head in the clouds. And I think that's very, very important. But I think that your circle of, we do have Mavis in common, and she is,
the business.
The business. There's few words to describe that woman. I love her. but, that group that you do really, really wrap yourselves into, it actually is really small, I think, what it is ultimately. We have lots and lots of friends and lots of acquaintances, but the ones where you can ring, the ones who you can ring and say, I think I made a mistake. Mm. What do you think? And not have them, give you a platitude or try to make you feel better, as opposed to just be honest and say, yeah, you did. That group is small, which is okay, as long as they're there.
I'm going to talk about some really impact leadership moves. So you're in an organisation, big responsibility, big team, delivering some really big outcomes. Let's take it right back to women on farm or in community on marae, who actually also have to deliver on some big impacts, but don't necessarily have a structured team. They get who's around them at the time. What are some of the big lessons that you've learned that really work?
I think that's a great question, Lindy, actually, because more and more, and I think COVID made me think about leadership where you expect it, and then leadership where you are surprised by it, and leadership that I love to see show itself. And increasingly I love to see leadership show itself in really quiet but impactful ways. So I work with a woman in the Māori space, Carrie Stoddard-Smith, and she is a quiet leader. She's a quiet person in my experience. She might not be otherwise, but I think she's quiet, but her mind is incredibly sharp, and she writes beautifully and has a way of articulating herself that demonstrates leadership in a way that that you don't see in other places. And so I love being surprised in that way. I think that one of the fundamentals to leadership, irrespective of who you are and where you find yourselves or you find yourself, is confidence in self and voice. And in order to have those, you have to appreciate your value. But it's actually finding the ability to say the words that will impact others.
Yeah.
And I think that comes, as I say, from understanding what your value is in your community, in your whānau, in your hapū, your iwi, your neighbourhood, your business. Anywhere you find yourself, I think that it's incumbent on us, if we wish to have impact, to think about what value do I have here? What values do I bring to this occasion? And I'm pretty hot on the idea of values-led leadership and values-led business. And that in order to understand that, it can't be a passing thought. You have to find some time to sit down and think about what are the things that are really important to me? How do I say those words? And how do I demonstrate that in my life? And then beyond that, how do I want to use those powers wisely? So who are the people that are aligned to my thinking and where am I going to find a natural fit? Because when you fit with your values and others, when those two lock together, it's like when you click a lock into place and all of a sudden it opens up. And that's what I think, where you have values-led and values-aligned businesses and relationships, the sum is much, much greater than its parts.
Confidence is such a biggie for women. And confidence and competence are not necessarily on the same line, because we've got great demonstrations around the world at the moment of highly confident, well, actually, let's say men, but may not necessarily be highly competent. Yeah. Whereas we have a lot of really competent women who don't necessarily have confidence, and finding that courage to actually find their voice. Because if we can't find our voice, we can't bring our real authentic, we can't be heart-led if it's stifled here, is a real challenge. How have you supported women sort of see the magic that is within them and help support them find their voice?
So when I started Yellow Brick Road, I was young, Māori, in a world that's really orthodox, fisheries, and I had a startup, and otherwise there were big businesses, and so you'd find yourselves in environments where one thing was never like the other. That actually still now, sort of 25 years later, still describes a lot of places that I and you find ourselves. You look around the room, you think, one of these things is not like the other. And at that moment, and I started, I guess, reflecting on it and thinking, what was that? And what it was is that you were, and I was at the time, you know, you're a unicorn. So you are this rare and mythical creature. And at the minute you realize that, I think women have a couple of choices. One is that you fold and retreat, because that is a very scary prospect. That's super uncomfortable. And on a number of days, that's a really valid response, because we cannot have energy every day to be the unicorn. It's too much.
Yeah.
But if you can, then the beauty in being a unicorn and being rare and mythical is that you are instantly seen, and that half the battle of being heard is being seen. And so you have this golden opportunity to be heard. And what you hope is that the audience that you are engaging with has the foresight to value different kinds of experience and knowledge. And this, for me, at the moment, is not even really about men and women so much as it is about valuing Māori knowledge and the fact that it doesn't resemble Western knowledge, but it's as, if not more, valuable to us, because it's about connection and whakapapa and whānau, and all of the things you've seen play out in the last few months through COVID can be quite easily described within the Māori world for nōngatanga and manaakitanga and being good kaitiaki. They all play themselves out in a certain way. So that's a knowledge set that is different to most people's.
But also, I think, a value set.
Yeah, it's still a value set. So the concepts of those values are really common to all of us. And so it's about valuing other people's experiences and value sets. So women will respond and behave differently to men. That is just a fact, and that is the beauty of it. I mean, who wants more of the same, really?
Well, more of the same, we'll just get more broken.
Yeah, you just get the same outcome. Yeah. And so the diversity of thinking and the diversity of thought, and why companies perform better when they have more diverse employment and engagement, is because you don't have the same thinking. And so when women find themselves, I think, in environments where you can feel your throat closing up because you look around and it might be, you know, a ballroom full of men in suits, or it might be a paddock full of men in gumboots, or it could be, you know, just an environment where you don't feel like you fit. The alter ego of not fitting is that kind of, as I say, rare and mythical unicorn moment where you go, hey, I'm the only one who's like this, so let's go. So it's a mind shift, it's a decision you make, and you've got to have the energy for it, and it doesn't always work, but when it does, it's a conversation you might not have had otherwise, and it's a gift that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
I mean, I am incredibly blessed, privileged, I don't know, you could have a lot of platitudes around what I get to see in my life. 4,000 women now have come through our programs.
Mm.
And the switch that occurs when there is a realization that their skills, their knowledge, even their ancient knowledge of the Maori woman, to come to the fore is going to radically change things, which is pretty pretty amazing. You know, early in the conversation, you talked about champion, mentors, coaches. I think it's sponsors. I think it's a really interesting thing to unpick because each has a role, and they kind of get a little bit sort of confused. So for you, what's the difference between a sponsor, a mentor, and your champion?
So a mentor for me, and I've never had formal mentors that I've gone to and said, could you mentor me? I have been approached lots of times to do that. And I think I hadn't, because I hadn't fully understood what that would have represented. But for me, a mentor is somebody who can be with you often, who can provide example to you, who can help you understand what you believe your path might be and what your opportunities could resemble, and then helps you build yourself into a space where you can take advantage of the opportunities. That's a brief description, but that's what I think a mentor does. A sponsor, I think, is somebody who says, you've got these skills, that's great, and I'll look for opportunities for you, and, you know, put in a good word for you, and leg up in that respect. A champion, however, is, I think, somebody who gives you a little bit of themselves and uses some of their street cred, who really puts themselves on the line for you and says, hey Lindy, whether you believe you're capable of doing this or not, I think you are, and I'm going to pop you in this position and let's see how that goes. And because one hopes that your respect for the person who puts you in that position is great enough, you know, you live up to it. And for yourself, you know, your self-respect is great enough that you think, well, I can do this and I'm going to live up to it and I'm going to build the tracks while the train's on it. But that's what a champion does. And if it all goes really pear-shaped, that's the worst that can happen. But as I say, it's the person putting themselves on the line for you. And you have to be ready to risk a little bit of yourself in that as well as the person who is championed. So it's not one I think we see very much of.
But we've got to be able to do it for one another as well.
Totally.
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole, you know, I've got this seat at the table and I'm going to hold on to it. You know, that's got to go. You know, in the 15 years I've been watching and looking at this, there's definitely been a shift, but it hasn't been a big enough shift. And that pathway is quite sort of challenging getting your first, but there's lots of opportunity. I mean, the woman that I'm working on the program with at the moment, you know, they are they're right in the grassroots, on marae, in community, with iwi, with whanau, doing all this amazing stuff. But how do you build on those next steps for those board positions? When you kind of can sometimes have a layer that sit right across the top, because at the end of the day, Treasury go, yes, we want that. But you've got to have experience.
Yeah.
So we want diversity, but we want experience.
Yeah.
Any advice?
Yeah, I think board appointments are a bit like a snowball. They do build a momentum because you do build muscles quite quickly that you didn't have previously. So where the first one you're quite green, you quickly adapt and you understand what it is to sit around that table. And I remember my first board appointment, and it was the same person who put me on that borders who put me in the States. And it was a woman, I should say, which is amazing. So I don't think I spoke for about a year. I do think my fellow board members thought I might have been mute because I just could not
find your voice.
I couldn't find my voice. I didn't know what I was adding. And then I sat down with the chair and he said to me, "You're quite quiet," which is literally the first time in my life that anyone had said that to me. I was like, "Are you talking to me?" But he sat down and he said, "You're very quiet. And why is that?" And I said, "Well, I don't really like wasting words. If people have said a similar thing to me, I tend not to want to repeat." And he said, "Yeah, but the way that you say it will be different to the way that that person said it. And you might not appreciate that yet, but it is absolutely going to be different because you're different." Mm. And that, I think, unlocked a gate for me, and then you step through it and then away you go. So that explains, I think, the how it feels when you first enter it, and then from that point position snowball because you build the skills you need to be an effective and responsible director. I do think that it becomes wearing when you believe yourself to be a box that's been ticked, and you start resisting or refusing invitations to take up roles or positions because it's patently clear that you are that requirement for them, as opposed to being brought on board or put onto a board or in a position because you have the requisite skill set. And hey ho, you're also a Māori woman, so you have a whole set of life experiences and knowledge that are going to make us even better than we were. So the positions need to be reversed.
Yeah, but it's utopia versus reality, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. And so there is a period of time where we do take up positions because I'm a firm believer that you have to be inside the tent in order to be a part of the conversation, for the most part. There's times when you, by design, stay outside because you don't agree so fundamentally with what's happening that you need to stay outside of that mess, as you might perceive it to be. But a lot of the time, I think there's power in being inside the team because you can influence people's thinking and their discussions. In terms of getting on them, a huge amount of that comes down to networking. And this takes me all the way back to the idea of understanding your value, because when you network with people, you have to understand what value you can offer them, and vice versa, they do too. It is, networking is an exchange of value. And unless you fully know and feel and believe yours, it's hard for other people to see through you and see that. So networking, being uncomfortable, meeting new people, also understanding what interests you, because when you find something that interests you, it can't just be any kind of a board. For you know, I wouldn't join a board that I wasn't interested in because I know I wouldn't be the best version of myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
not just a matter of cracking one off just to, you know, get in. You want to be pretty good straight out of the gates.
Networks are a really interesting thing. They're really challenging for a lot of women. And I think we have to, you know, flip the idea of what we think a network is. It isn't going with your champagne glass into a crowd, you know. They have to be open. They have to be diverse. They have to be deep. Deep enough so that you could ask a favour. You know, like me going, "Hey, Rachel, will you come to this podcast with me?"
You did, though, bring me watercress and dinner, so I feel like you could come back weekly.
Okay, really happy to
do. Series.
Yeah. See, absolutely, build on it. We've got to change how we think about network. You know, you may have an operational network, you may have a strategic network, and you have your personal network. And I think when we start seeing it a little bit differently, then things open up, because, you know, I know a lot of women, particularly agri women, are sitting out there going, "Well, I don't know how to start or get into a network." And particularly for me, my big concern is how do we create the space where we have Māori women and Pākehā women coming together, because the challenges ahead are so big. We have to be able to bring women together, and in order to achieve some of these big challenges.
We do. It's inclusivity. I just had a conversation with Lily, my 15-year-old. There's a lot of conversation, you know, to wear Black Lives Matter. I said to her school, "I think we should create a forum where the kids can unpack their feelings and thoughts about that together, because it's pretty heavy and it's hard to untangle all of that." And Lily and I talked about it, and she's Māori, Samoan, Pākehā, and so we talk about the idea of inclusivity. You need to be a strong young Māori woman, and you can be a strong young Samoan woman, and there's a place for being a strong young Pākehā woman. And the world, it's difficult for the world to function effectively as just one of those things.
Yeah.
And so you need to create a space for them to be inclusive and meld in together without one of them diluting the other, and that's eminently possible. It doesn't have to be, you know, one detracting from another to gain strength. They just can, you know, rise together.
But there's a lot of learning and understanding.
Oh, there's loads. Yeah.
And one thing this has, I think, it's pulled back the curtains on things that we didn't understand, didn't see. So I think it'll be a good thing. This is how do we create, you know, if we're talking about networks, then they've got to be diverse.
They do. Always has to be a reason for them.
Yeah.
And they have to be, it has to be a give and take. So
absolutely. I do an interview with you, yeah. I give you some food.
Exactly, yeah. Right. I claim to the family that I made it. No, okay. No, we don't. Okay. That's not true.
Are we gonna edit this? Delete this.
I think
But what if they ask you what's in it?
They won't know anyway, because I'm the one who cooks in this family, so I could say anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, back to networks.
I think for me, I've got a rule for myself that if any young person rings me and says, "I'm Anna, could I meet you for a coffee? I just have some questions, you know, for you. Mm-hmm. I'd love some advice on this." I will never say no, because how busy does one person have to be really in order to say no to a young person who is reaching out for you and making themselves profoundly uncomfortable in doing so, that you'd say no to that? Why would you say no to that? So
Am I in that young category?
100%. Yeah, thank 100%. You. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
So I think if we all kind of had that deal, that would be great, because then you're starting to build young women in this instance, because it's usually is young women. Occasionally it's young men. And the exchange is usually really unfair. So we get there, they think they're all going to be, you know, fizzed up and topped up and advised by me. And we leave and I'm like, that was so awesome. I'm so excited. And here's like five people you need to go and talk to as well. And I think I leave more jazzed than they probably do. But hopefully there's merit in them for there. But I think as a general rule, when people reach out to you for help, irrespective of age or gender, New Zealand is the scale or lack thereof that we should be able to say yes. And it might not be all of yourself for an infinite amount of time. It might only be a small exchange, but that pay it forward mentality, and with women and leadership and positions of influence as well, if you are in a position of leadership and then by extension influence, you have a really great responsibility to bring others with you. And the reason why I would continue to stand up and meet and talk like this, or present at a conference, or meet somebody for a coffee, is because I think it's a bit of a cliche, it's a bit of a bumper sticker, but you know, you have to see it to be it. So unless we have more stories and more faces and more other ways of being that represents an alternative face, emotion, thinking, any of it, then you can't be it. How would you know what that might look or resemble unless you had felt it? So I think you need to see it to be it, and that the responsibility comes from those of us with the sphere of influence to do that.
So the last question, ask this question to everybody. 15 years from now, we've absolutely nailed food production systems and food for Aotearoa. Food insecurity is sorted, and we're on our way to being able to produce food that is going to be less resistant to climate impacts, and we'll still have an economic benefit for producing food. What do we need to do now?
Apart from
me getting in my car
and going to do a webinar about it all.
Yeah, but
what do we do now? So what you've just asked me is like, how do we eat the elephant?
Yeah.
And there's always only one answer to that question, and it's just one bite at a time. Mm. And we all are responsible for our own spheres. And the one that's in my sphere at the moment, because I resist ideas of universality.
Yeah.
Because I think that when you come up with a universal solution to a perceived problem, by and large you miss out a whole chunk of the people who are experiencing that problem, because people feel things in different ways. So I don't have a universal response to what do we do now. I can only tell you what I am doing or what we're doing.
Love to hear that.
And that is that we're really thinking about what does it mean to, in our business, to be in a tikanga-led regenerative agriculture space.
Yeah.
A lot of regen agriculture conversation going around, which is really good. I think it's spurred on by COVID, where we all took a breath and saw the effects of taking a breath on Papatuanuku. Like it's just, everyone went, holy, like I flew the
other
day.
We've got birds in the city.
I flew yesterday and I saw Taranaki Maunga and Ruapehu, flight. I was like, what? That's amazing. And so...
Even in Ikarahuna, on the farm, I noticed the sky, and there's no industry in Ikarahuna, but the sky was for months. It was different.
So it showed our connectivity to each other and to the whenua, and so you think, cool, so we get it. That's a glimpse of what could be, right?
Absolutely.
So let's take a minute and think about rewarding and motivating the people who have the ability to do it well in that way, and is that a public-private partnership between government and private industry to fast-track that as a nation, because as an individual, as a company, as a country, a conversation is coming about our footprint, and it's not even coming, that's silly, because it's been here for some time. It's just been, I guess, revisited in a different way through COVID, and we could be ahead of the international curve in that respect. So regenerative agriculture for us as a business, as a primary industry business, but more than that, we need to be tikanga-led. So, you know, what did we used to do? Because we used to be in harmony with te tai ao, our environment, in a way that ensured that all of our families were fed, that we, you know, kai was a gift. We would use it in ways that ensured it was there for...
All.
And we had a relationship where it was about wise and enduring use. So it wasn't about conservation. It's different. This is about wise and enduring use and a relationship to your land. So for us, we have to do the tikanga-led as well, because it gives authenticity to that process, as against following a more perhaps Western style philosophy in around regen. We got to root it in a different place that hopefully gets us to the same place, a different space rather. So that's really exciting and terrifying at the same time, because I don't know the answer. And all the way back to wanting to be right. You know, my desire to just nail things is thwarted slightly by the fact that I don't know the answer here, but I'm super excited about the process and the process of reconnection and enlightenment and learning.
And it's a little bit scary. Obviously, I'm a sheep and beef farmer from Ikarahuna. You know, we're really blessed. You know, my son will be fifth generation. Highly unlikely that he will farm. But David's grandfather, he felled all the native trees. The end of his life, he was replanting them.
Yeah.
And so we have had four generations of planting. We've protected native bits of land. And yeah, some of our practices are starting to change. And think about, well, what does that actually look like? You're balancing people, your environment, profit. We've got to be profitable. More than ever now, New Zealand agriculture has to be profitable, because we've got to lift the country back into some sort of prosperity. Thank you so much for the conversation today. I really wish you were right on this one. You will be. You will be.
I feel like I probably will be.
And I really hope
to take a bet on myself.
I really hope you enjoy your meal.
I'm excited about my meal and my watercress. I just can't.
Well, I need to tell you the watercress story. I didn't tell you. So I said, right, I'm going to go and pick Rachel some watercress. So sent the tane out to scout for the watercress. Came back. I found it. Here it is. So I said, well, let's go and do this together. So we're picking it away. And I started eating it. And I went, holy moly, this is delicious. Last night, cress salad, oranges.
Beautiful.
I put some oranges, a little bit of feta, goat's feta. Just a little bit of orange juice. It was so delicious.
Yeah.
And so thank you.
I'm not putting that in a boiler, because if we put it in a boiler, it'll all get sort of lost in the noise. That's definitely salad material and beautiful and peppery and
beautiful.
Superfood.
So thank you so much.
You
for
are so
the
welcome.
Today.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah. You're an amazing, strong Wahine Māori woman in leadership in agriculture in New Zealand. And you are creating a trail of people who want to be you.
Wow. well, then they'd have the autographs, but we can't have that.